on behalf of Atticus, welcome everyone and welcome Ron. And Susan just talked about the website. If you go there, you'll also find information on Ron and connection to Ron's website. And I'll give you Ron's direct website at some point during this call so you can go there. And let me talk a little bit about Ron, so those of you that haven't been on prior calls. Ron Baker, he started his accounting career in 1984 with KPMG, and he is the founder of Verisage Institute, and it's a think tank dedicated to teaching value pricing to professionals around the world. Ron has authored 11 courses, and there's too many of them to go through for the CPA Education Foundation. He's the author of a number of best-selling books, and one of them, which most of you or a lot of you may have read on this call, is The Professional's Guide to Value Pricing, which is in his sixth edition. He's also done Burying the Billable Hour, Trashing the Timesheet, and You Are Your Customer List, which I particularly love and believe. And Ron has been kind enough to come on two Graduate Network calls, which are recorded. So if you haven't listened to those, you may want to go back to the website and listen to them. And talking about the different approaches and thinking about value pricing in the law firm. And then Ron agreed, there were so many questions that people had, Ron agreed to come on to another call just to have an open dialogue about your experiences with value pricing, the issues you've confronted, or just questions in general about why it works and what doesn't work, and to have an open dialogue about it. So Ron is going to, if you're open to it, Ron, if you're willing to just do a little quick overview of some of the things we've talked about in the past, and then we'll just open this call up to questions and thoughts from some of the participants. And before we do that, Ron, to everyone else on the call, as Ron's just doing a quick recap of his past two conversations, which might be tricky to do a recap, it was so good. Think about your experiences with value pricing, your questions about it, and where you may have experimented, and what you think did work or didn't work. And then we'll open up the questions with Ron. So, Ron, why don't you go ahead and take it from there?
Great. Thank you, Mark. And thanks, everybody, for joining us today. This is great. Real quick recap on the last two calls, because they did go pretty much in great depth on the theory behind this topic. If you have pencil and paper in front of you, I'd like you to write down two chains for me, and that will be the best way to recap it. The way hourly billing works now, if you were to draw a chain, it would start with the service that you're going to provide, and then it would move to the cost of that service, and that is you filling out the timesheet, tracking the time. And then we take that and we determine the price. And then we hope that the price is either equal to or less than the value to the customer. So the chain for cost plus pricing or hourly billing is service, cost, price, value, customer or client. If you look at that chain, you'll notice that the client's at the end. It's like the client's an afterthought. Yet the last two calls, I think, explain fairly well why it's the client who is the sole arbiter of the value of anything that we buy, not just legal services, but you as a customer are the sole arbiter of the value of anything in this world. The value of things that we pay for is not determined by the cost of producing them. It is determined by the value as perceived by customers. And therefore, the chain that we're looking at with hourly billing, it goes against how humans behave. So we think a better chain is the subjective theory of value, or what I'm going to call value pricing for purposes of this call, and that actually starts with the client is the first in the second chain, and the client determines the value, and it's the value that determines the price, and it's the price that determines the costs that you're willing to invest in as a firm to produce the service. So the second chain is customer value, price, cost, service. It's a direct inversion of the first chain. Now, I know that's relatively theoretical, but it's really not. It's very practical because it leads to a totally different way of thinking about pricing, thinking about how we're going to communicate and create value for the customer, how we're going to enhance the client's perception of value, and then how we're going to try and capture some of that value with pricing strategies. Hourly billing is not only failing clients, it fails law firms because there's no correlation between billable hours and value. To the extent that there's any correlation, it's usually coincidental. It doesn't give the client certainty in price, which is what clients love. We wouldn't, as one attorney explained it to me, and it's the best way I've ever heard it summed up, I'd never buy the way I sell. None of us on this call would buy things where we didn't know the price before we buy, and yet we expect clients, and I don't care whether they're business or consumer clients, to engage us and not know the price before they engage us. I think it's insane, and it flies against economic reality out there. And how we've been able to get away with it for as long as we have is an interesting question, but one I won't dive into. But that's the best way I can think of, Mark, to sum up the last two calls.
Great. Thanks, Ron. And so what I'd like to do is, I know that a number of you have been experimenting with it and or had questions about value pricing or getting a dialogue about it. So I'm going to open it up for questions. And if you would just say your name and city, and then we'll take it from there. And if I'm not responding right away, it means that you're probably still on mute.
Ron, I have a question. My name is Lonnie Balby from Calgary.
Okay.
Calgary, okay. Calgary. Where is Calgary?
Far north.
I've been there.
Okay.
The rodeo, right before the rodeo thing, yeah.
That's right. And you knew the price before you walked in there.
That's right.
So you talk about in your book about the service guarantee, and that thing, I do a matrimonial practice. And one of the things that you stress in there in terms of having a guarantee to the client is to have a service guarantee that if they're not completely satisfied with the service that they receive at the end, you could refund the entire cost.
Right.
Scares the hell out of me in what I do. And
sure.
Because I'm dealing with people who are basically not very happy when they come in here and usually not very happy at the end because they have to pay a lot of money, even if we set the fee up front. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about the service guarantee and how it might apply to a matrimonial practice.
Okay, great. And Mark Chin probably could chime in on this as well because he's got the same type of practice. But remember that the service guarantee is not based on a contingency. In other words, if you don't win the lawsuit, if the client doesn't get the desired outcome from the court, you're not guaranteeing an outcome. You're just guaranteeing the service of your firm. And so even though, I'm not a lawyer, so my service guarantee might be written a little bit too loose for most lawyers' taste, you could tighten up the language and make it very clear that it's only a service guarantee based on their satisfaction with your firm, not on any type of an outcome. And the reason we do that is, and David Maester's argued about this and other people, other thought leaders to the profession have argued for a service guarantee for many years. The reason we do that is we want to take away risk from the client. And to the extent that you can remove risk from the client, you can be perceived as a higher valued provider and therefore charge a higher price. So I'm asking you, Lonnie, basically, to give the service guarantee to everybody and kind of self-insure it. Will some people abuse it? Yes. What will that percentage be? 1%, 2%? How often will they abuse it? Probably not very often. But you'll be more than compensated for the higher price premium you'll get because you'll be spreading that risk over all your clients and spreading that higher price against all your clients. So I'm asking you kind of to take an actuarial gamble on it. And I think it makes incredible sense. It puts the client at ease. It definitely gives you a point of differentiation from your competition. How many lawyers are out there guaranteeing themselves? There are law firms that do it, and I just think it's a really smart strategy. It's very customer focused.
How do you do the to differentiate between the outcome of the matter and the service guarantee? I mean, people get very caught up in the emotions in the work that we do. And often they see the service that we provide is very much related to the outcome.
Yeah, and I think you're an attorney, so you could write something probably that explains that a little bit better than my examples. But the fact of the matter is, sure, your people are very an emotional stage in their life. We have veterinarians that offer the same guarantee. Now, you want to play on people's emotions, you know, operate on their dog and have their dog die. And what you'll find is that, you know, people aren't unreasonable. And if they are unreasonable, well, then maybe they did you a favor because you don't ever have to work with them again. I think the fear that people are going to take advantage of you is unfounded based on the empirical evidence. And I'd be happy to hear if Mark Chin has any thoughts on this as well. He's out there.
Yeah, I don't know if Mark's on the call.
Okay.
Well, one of the things, Mark has actually written something on this, and I've read it, and the thing that he says is that he's got the same fear I do, and he was thinking that maybe what we could do is have a service guarantee that up until the last billing, like sort of the last month of billing that I've billed you, if you don't complain, then it's fine. But if you do complain, I'll refund the last month's worth of billing.
Absolutely. Lonnie, if you gave a fixed price, say, for an engagement, you could certainly set up payment terms, however that might work, quarterly, monthly, over some period of time. And you could put, you could slam the door. Once they pay, you'll assume they're satisfied. So you're only exposing yourself for possible future refunds. And you could write the guarantee in such a way that, every time they make a payment, you're going to assume that they're satisfied for all the past services. So there is ways to tighten up that guarantee.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
But experiment with it. Experiment with it. That's the big thing. One of the things I hope we get across today really clearly is in the pricing arena, you have to experiment with different things.
Thanks, Lonnie. Thanks, Ron. Let me open up another question.
Cannon, Houston.
Hey, go ahead.
I still don't understand how your value pricing works for litigation because you don't know going in how much you're going to have to work. So can you give me a little bit better explanation of that? I've read your book, and I've listened to your other lectures, but going into something, I don't know whether I'm going to have two or three or four hearings on discovery disputes or other things, and I have no idea how much time I'm going to have to spend on it. How does that work for that?
Well, the big answer here with litigation, and of course the litigators are certainly the most vocal opponents to any switch from hourly billing. But the big answer here is you have to put things in phases. You have to scope out what you do know. I think you sell yourself short when you say you have no idea. I mean, and certainly you wouldn't want to tell that to a client. I mean, I'm engaging you because you're a pro from Dover. You've been down this road, a million times. Hopefully you're an expert at this. You certainly know the contingencies. You know where the mines are better than I do as a client. I really want you to think about
it. Yeah,
I
figured that.
If you're worried about it, imagine how your client feels. And then imagine how your client feels with an open checkbook that you're just going to log hours and bill him. You have to give some level of certainty about those things that you do know, put a scope around it, and then use change orders when things come up. If the judge does something weird, if discovery takes longer than you thought, if depositions go on, whatever it might be, then use change orders just like a contractor or an auto mechanic. So I'd say that the short answer to your question is use phasing. Phase what you do know, put scope around it, and give certainty and price for that phase. And then when things change, use a change order.
Neil is an example, and it's not exactly the same scenario. And by the way, I will say something, Neil, is that you all, most of the graduates on this call, are at the cutting edge in the legal profession on doing this because many of your colleagues don't even know about it or are fearful of it or those sort of things. And the great thing about you all is you encourage each other to try this, experiment with this, and let's see what happens. Does it serve our clients better? Does it make us more profitable? Does it make our business work better? Those sort of things. And as an example of that, and it's not an exact example. If you look at Lonnie Balby, who was just on the call, he had not only created and licensed this, is licensing this to other family law attorneys, he created a matrimonial assessment as the first phase. And it's a fixed fee service that used to be an hourly consulting phase and still is for most family law or matrimonial attorneys. But it's a fixed phase that gives the client control over that intake process. And what Lonnie does in his process is just load in value during that process and has an extremely high conversion ratio of those ones that he wants. Not only is his assessment profitable, but the conversion ratio for the ones he wants to be client is extremely high. So it's that's one phase in the process that definitely, even in a commercial lit practice or litigation practice, could be done on value pricing.
And Mark, to add to that, if people visit my website, verisage.com, under community blog, you will find posts from Chris Marston. Chris Marston is the CEO of Exemplar Law up in Boston, doesn't use timesheets, doesn't bill by the hour. He wrote a fantastic blog post on scope, and this is exactly the issue we're talking about. How do you scope things? How do you put a fixed price around a scope, even in uncertain and risky items? And it's just a fantastic post. So you can find that on our website.
Hello. Hi. It's Victoria in Dallas.
Hi, Victoria. And, Victoria, let me just give that website, that spelling for people. It's www.verasage.com.
Right.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Victoria.
Yes, following up on the last person's question.
Neil?
And I am encountering this very issue with a potential client who is a CPA, as a matter of fact.
No, you're really in trouble.
And we are only in the discussion phases. Here's my reservation about the change order. What did you call it?
Change order. Yep.
Change order or something else. Amendment. In our rules of professional responsibility in Texas, it presumes that any amendment to a contract with a client post-representation is unfair.
That's right. I agree with that. And the change order is not post-representation. It's actually before you do anything.
Well, I'm saying, no. Post, well, in other words, once post-commencement. I'm sorry, I wasn't being precise. If it's post-commencement, in other words, any modification of a contract, once commencement has started, is presumed to be unfair. Not after it's over, but after
the
relationship is formed, it's considered to be unfair.
That's why your initial contract, your initial legal representation agreement, has to be, you know, fairly precise about the price that you're charging and what you're doing for that price. And if things happen outside of that scope, that you are going to use a change order negotiated ahead of time and priced before, that works.
So the change order, okay, so let's, taking the last person's example, and this is the problem I encounter as well. I know it'll take me this much time to do my answers, my own can of discovery. I may even predict how long it can take to answer the other person's discovery. What I don't know how to price is when I get that big fat motion for summary judgment, how long it's going to really take me to respond to it so my client is not on the losing end of it. Or something else, the magnitude of which you can't really predict in any other way other than the hours and the efforts. The effort it's going to take to get the result your client hopes for, which is obviously to win the litigation. What do you do with the kinds of services that you truly can't predict based on, the opposing lawyer's strategy?
Well, you can predict them at some point. I mean, you can't predict them maybe at the outset, but once they come at you, you can predict them. I mean, what scares me is if you stay locked into this mindset that the only way to figure it out is to charge hours, well, then we're just right back into the hourly billing trap, and the only way to make more money is bill more hours. And I think that's what's killing the legal profession. I mean, you guys aren't selling time. Your clients aren't buying time. If you give a fixed price for a very defined scope, then I am arguing to you or with you that you will be able to charge a premium price because you're giving the client certainty in price. A fixed price from an attorney, even for a defined limited scope, is worth more to me than an attorney who looks at me and says, I'm going to charge you $250 an hour, and I have no clue how long this is going to take. And, you know, I think one of the issues here is we have to focus outward rather than inward. We're so worried about how long it's going to take us, or how much time, and the risk and the uncertainty. But folks, Lloyd's of London gives me earthquake insurance on my home here in Northern California, and they have no idea when the next one's going to strike. They have no idea how big it's going to be. They have no idea how much damage it's going to cost. And yet I have a fixed premium. It's called pricing risk and uncertainty. And yes, you have to do it. You're doing it now with the billable hour. It's just that, you know, we write down and we write off when the client complains. I'm saying if you price what you do know up front, use phases, use change orders, you'll be able to command a higher price because you're taking away, just like the service
guarantee. And so where's the website? Which website can I go to find a sample contract that actually does this?
Well, you can go to our website, and some of it is in my books, but a great legal resource for firms that have done this is a book published by the ABA's Law Practice Management section called Winning Alternatives to the Billable Hour. And it's on the, and Mark, I'll send you this link, but it's at the lawpractice.org/catalog website. And this is in its second edition. And I was telling Susan about this too. There is a disc in the back of this book that has sample legal representation agreements that law firms around the country are using to implement some of these ideas with fixed pricing.
And it's Winning Alternatives to the Billable Hour?
To the Billable Hour, correct. Strategies that Work. It's in the second edition. It's actually a follow-up to Richard Reed's work, who was a pioneer in this area as late as the mid or the late 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just done Herculean work on demolishing the logic of the billable hour.
Ron, I truly appreciate what you say. The problem I have and what I still find a bit daunting is when the client wants you to predict the down-the-road events on the day that you're signing the contract.
And
I agree with
you. You can't do that. Who can predict the future? I'm not asking you to have a crystal ball. And I think a client...
But clients do.
But I think that's unreasonable, and I think maybe we should not work with those clients. But you have to manage their expectations. You have to tell them, look, nobody can predict the future. I can tell you probable outcomes based on our vast firm experience. It could go this way, it could go this way, it could go this way, or it could go this way. And a reasonable person will accept that.
And, Victoria, you may want to check with, there's two, because you do a, for people that may not know on the call, Victoria, you do a family law practice, correct?
I do a family and civil, largely litigation.
Okay. You may want to do an email and we can get you the email addresses afterwards. Richard West out of Orlando or Mark Chin out of Jackson, Mississippi. Both of those have had to develop contracts to handle this because both of them, and I don't think I'm telling anything out of school that they would be upset
mm-hmm.
about, both of them in the last year or a little over the last year have doubled their revenues, and they would tell you that the reason they've been able to do that is because they went to value pricing. And their clients are happier, they're happier with it. There's some tricky elements to it. So it's some of those things that I don't know how to say this, other than you have to struggle through some things and rely on some of our friends to see how it's working and then experiment into it, taking baby steps if need be. And these guys each took baby steps.
Mm-hmm.
And then before you knew it, they were pricing at a level that shocked them. But it was making the client happy because they had basically a basic fixed fee. It was higher than they probably would have gotten an hourly practice.
Oh, I am sold on that. It's the mechanics and the how to do it and how to manage it, Mark, is
great. Right.
Of course, as you know,
the devil's in the
details. Yeah.
Well, you may want to email those guys, and at some point, I wish that I don't think Richard's on the call either. They could speak to that. But if anyone's on this call that's actually been doing the value pricing and can speak to some of the things Victoria is, please jump up and say so. And
yeah, Mark?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, this is Jack Ross.
Hello, Jack.
Gainesville. Yeah, I'd like to reiterate what Victoria said. I've read Ron's book. I've been on two, you know, and to me, the question is not if. I just can't figure out how yet.
Yeah.
But one thing I did was to, and as a result of what Ron and you have said, I was able to identify at least one specific service that I could put some boundaries around, and I could fix a price for it. And that's what I've done. Just not every case. I'm still working on that, but there is one service that I provide that that I've managed to price, and it seems to be well received.
And that's, you have a commercial lit practice. What were you able to put the boundaries around, Jack?
Well, just an evaluation, not a not a representation. But when somebody comes in and says, "Do I have a case?" Or "How strong is my case?" Or "How should I go?" Rather than charge them a huge retainer to get involved on an hourly basis, I say, "Okay, for this fee, I will do an evaluation of your case and give you a report and give you my recommendation on how you proceed." And you know, if you want to proceed to court, then I will talk with you about what your fees will be in that situation.
So it's almost like that intake assessment that it's sort of a product sort of that Lonnie has, is a product around deciding whether you have a case or not.
That's correct.
And packaging it and naming it, that's really the beauty of some of the value pricing. And excuse me, tell me if I'm wrong there, Ron, but if you get to package these and price some of these things and actually give them, turn them into products.
Right,
service.
Exactly. It tangibilized the intangible. Jack, I kind of think of your, this is a very crude metaphor, but I kind of think of your productization there is a needs and diagnostic or a needs and analysis.
Yeah. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, and that's an example of phasing. You know, it's going to take us some time to get our arms around this, to figure out what you can do, what the possible strategies are, and here's the price for this. And then before you move into phase two, when you're 80-90% done with phase one,
mm-hmm.
you should probably know what's going to happen in phase two. You have, because you're the pro, you've been down this road. You can price phase two for what you do know. And then get that agreement before you start work on phase two. That's the key. It's the same thing the mechanic does when he calls you and says, "Hey, you know, you need brakes too." He gives you a price before you authorize him to move on. Otherwise, he doesn't work.
This is Cannon again. Jack, do you have a flat fee for that evaluation, or does it vary depending on the size of the case, or is it the same?
Well, basically, I have in my mind a fee that I charge regularly, usually in 10 minutes I can learn enough about the case. If it's too much or too little, I can adjust it.
Yeah, a lot of people, if I could chime in on that, a lot of people are very comfortable having a menu and you know, having standard prices. That always kind of makes me nervous because, you know, we are knowledge workers and every client is different.
Yep.
And I would hate to have you, you know, strapped in by a fixed price that you have on a menu or something. I rather keep it open-ended and make the value fit the particular client.
If there's anyone this call that hasn't done this particular program, I highly recommend it for two reasons. One is Steve Riley. Some of you might know him because he leads the out-of-the-box calls for the Graduate Network. Steve Riley has done a brilliant. He's one of my favorite value pricers, and he's done some brilliant job around packaging and pricing his services. Now, he's got an estate planning practice, and if you're a commercial lit, you say, well, that's easy. But the same process will follow through. But he leads a program called the Double Your Revenue Program. And if you haven't, it's a two-day thing, and if you haven't done it, he does it in his office. He has a training room in his office. It's brilliant. And he's doing one in March. So if you can get into that and get a seat in it, I highly recommend it. It's fairly inexpensive. But it's worth the price of admission just to tour and get ideas from what Steve is doing. So, Ron, let's open up some other questions as well. And thanks, Jack and Victoria.
Well, Mark, could I ask one more question?
Sure.
This is Jack. Ron, the one thing I've looked at and tried to get my arms around in phase two pricing is pricing by the service. In other words, if I go to a deposition, I charge you X amount. If I have a dispositive hearing, I charge you Y amount, which I think is more like unit billing, and that's not really what you're talking about, is it?
No. But the only way I'm comfortable with you quoting a price for those various units is if it's a minimum price. You know, if you have a minimum price to go do something, I think that's acceptable. And you'll find quoting that is a great way to chase away price-sensitive buyers, too, by the way. I'm a big fan of minimum pricing, but not necessarily, you know, menu pricing or unit pricing. Because
okay.
And then I'm on different.
Be gone.
Dominican Republic.
Good for you.
Yeah, man.
Let me just chime in there. Somebody who's ever saying good for you, and there's a dialogue going on in the background, and it's good for you, and someone else is in the room. Check your mute button if you would. Okay, Jack, did we answer that question for you?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
No, this is Dick Price.
Hello, Dick.
How are you?
You staying nice and warm over there, Dick?
Oh, mostly. The ice has gone away, finally.
That's the people you want to kill.
Anyway, I had a question about how long it might take to calculate a fee. I have a matrimonial practice also.
If
someone will come in and say, you know, they'll give me all the facts and they'll say I need to get a divorce, and I may do it as a collaborative case or I may do it as a regular litigated case, but I've got to think about...
You're crazy.
I do know.
But, all right, be good.
All right.
I've got to think about the various steps that I know are going to be needed. Are you normally able to have a fee based on the value of the service right away, or do you need to take some time and think about it and then get back to them?
Great question, Dick. Thank you. This is a fantastic question, and it's gonna allow me to make a point that's gonna make a lot of you probably uncomfortable.
Hey, Ron, could you do me a quick favor, though?
Sure.
Would you repeat the question real quick? Because I think there was some talking going on in the background.
Okay.
Everybody might not have got exactly what Dick was saying.
Dick wanted to know if you can, and I'm rephrasing this, Dick, but if you could quote a price in an initial client meeting or a client meeting when a client comes in, or do you have to kind of step back from the process, think about it, and get back to the client at some future time with a price? And here is 10 years of pricing wisdom distilled into one sentence. The quicker you quote a price, the lower it will be. And the reason it will be lower is because we're not thinking about the value to the customer. And the only way to get at the value to the customer is to have a great conversation with the customer and try and get as much information as you can. And so I actually want you to step back and think about exactly how you're going to price it, exactly the scope, you know, what are you going to provide for that price, and maybe even give the client some options that you didn't think about in the initial meeting. Maybe you come back with two or three different options and say, we could do this, we could do this, or we could do this, just like, you know, a green card, gold card, platinum card with American Express. I actually want to slow down the pricing process, which is why we recommend, if you're in a firm, that you have a pricing council or a pricing cartel, a group of people who do this, who price across the entire firm, and who they price every engagement, you know, above a certain dollar threshold, obviously. And that way they can tap into the experience and the knowledge of what's gone on in the past, what has worked, what hasn't, come up with some innovations, come up with some testing, you know, ideas to test, and also develop a core competency in pricing. I actually want you to slow down the pricing process. I mean, this isn't life and death stuff, so you can always step back, think about it, bounce it off a partner, bounce it off some other people in a pricing cartel. The more you think about it, the more you'll become obsessed with value. And the more heads you have together on this, and if they're good pricers or they become good pricers, you'll see your pricing start to improve. This is a skill like golf or tennis. The more you do it, the more you think about it, the better you'll get. So we're big advocates of having a pricing cartel. We're also big advocates of appointing a chief value officer, somebody who would actually think about value to the client, both pre-engagement and post-engagement. So I hope that answers your question, Dick. But yeah,
that's
slow down. Slow down, absolutely. No rush.
You know, Mark Chin tells the story of he had a client come in, and I'm sorry he's not on the call, but he had a client come in, and it was a lot of different circumstances, and he wasn't going to take the case at first, and then he thought about it, and he spent, I think he spent over a week before he ever gave the client a price, and when he did, he knocked the client off his seat with the price, and then when he told them what he was going to do, the plan, the process, it provided such extraordinary value to the client that the client took it and was happy, paid more than he probably ever would have, but he was extremely happy with the speed and the accuracy of the result.
Was that the $80,000 engagement, Mark?
Yeah.
That was the first thing that Mark had told, when he first contacted me, that's the first story he told me, and it blew me away.
Yes.
A great example of how we need to step back and think about what we're doing.
Yeah.
Mark?
Yes.
This is Kerry in Houston. I guess I'm still scratching my head because what I'm hearing, well, it just frankly confuses me. When I hear wanting to price at a minimum, but at the same time it seems the thrust of what we're talking about, giving the example of calling up on your car repair and having a brake job, if somebody tells me, well, it's going to cost at least $350, but it's open-ended, that gives me no comfort at all. So I'm confused about saying that you don't want a menu of pricing options. All you want is a minimum.
Well, I'll let Ron address that.
Yeah, a great question. You know, CPA firms are more, I think, adaptable to the minimum pricing concept because they can say, people call them up during tax time, how much does it cost for a tax return? And you can say, well, look, it's a minimum $500. And that just kind of chases away the price shoppers. That's the effectiveness of having a minimum price. I'm not suggesting that you quote any a price to a client until you know, just like the mechanic, exactly what you're going to do, and not just you know willy nilly quote a minimum price. So maybe, but if you're an estate attorney or something like that, you could say, well, look, a living will, whatever, is a minimum price. And your receptionist could quote that over the phone to kind of chase away the price shoppers. That's really the effectiveness of the minimum price. But I actually want you to quote a price that hopefully is the best that we can somehow correlated with the value to that particular client.
You know, there's a quote that goes, somehow it relates to this, there's a quote that goes, they never care, let's say they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And there's something about that with pricing, Ron. You know, it's sort of like they really, the pricing has a lot to do with how much they know that you understand and care. And
you know, the best is, I love Occam's razor, so the best way I can explain to get to a value price, the better your conversation is with the client,
yes,
the better you understand what you're doing, how they're valuing, what their goals and objectives are, your ability to manage their expectations, your ability to understand their value drivers, that's all based on conversation. It cannot be formalized. We can't put it into a formula. It requires judgment. It requires experience, intuition, professionalism. And that's what makes pricing the art that it is.
Yeah.
Excuse me, then. Let's say you have a client who's being sued.
I'm sorry, who's this?
It's Victoria.
Oh,
if you have
Victoria.
A client who's being sued, is that question one of how much is it worth to have this lawsuit over to you, or what is the most you would pay? I mean, how do you get the client to tell you that?
Well,
conversation you have, say, yes, if your client when being sued?
They're not going to come out and tell you directly.
Right.
I mean, no client has ever, you know, basically said, hey, you didn't charge me enough. But what you can do is you can try and figure out what they're trying to achieve. I'd want to know, you know, what it was worth to them to solve it, what would happen if we went into ADR. I mean, what are the options that are on the table? Because usually the client has a very different perspective than the attorneys, and I think you need to understand that before you can plot a course of action. So I think just having a conversation, the deeper that conversation is, the less you talk and the more the client talks, the better you'll be able to get at picking up on those value signals.
And there, Victoria, there are questions you can ask. For example, whenever I'm engaging at Atticus, when I'm engaging someone, I'm a big believer in this same concept. And we're always spending time just finding out first where they're coming from, their goals. And if you've been in Atticus for a while, you probably haven't done it. But new people always even go through a personality profile, so I can just know who they are and what their motivations are. But I usually will ask a question that will say something like, I want you to imagine that we've been working together for a year. Now, in your case, I want you to imagine that we've completed this suit or we've completed this issue. But we've been working together for a year, and we're sitting down having a conversation, and you are wildly excited about the results we've got. You're just wildly excited about it. What three things have to happen for you to say that you're wildly excited when we have that conversation? And what that automatically does is to bring our frame of reference or their frame of reference into answering, well, what do I really want out of this? And they start to think, and I help clarify that sometimes. So it's a value creation conversation or question. So there are questions like that. Ron, you may have others that you use and know.
Yeah, I have a whole list of questions to ask the customer, you know, in this conversation. But what we're trying to get at is we're trying to get at the client's criteria for success.
Yeah.
Don't we want to know how they're going to judge us, either a success or a failure? And don't we want to know that ahead of time? And the more you can figure that out, then you have the opportunity at that point to kind of manage those client expectations. If they're unreasonable, you can maybe educate the client or withdraw from the engagement. But I rather learn that before I did any work for them,
yep,
rather than after. So figure out what the criteria for success is. And that's not just a legal outcome. It's also a service and a feeling and an experience as well.
This is Jerry in Sarasota. In the area of litigation, what resource lays out the model of phasing that then would allow you to budget those phases?
Well, I think the ultimate answer to that question is project management. Really, when we talk about phasing, we're talking about project management. And project management, like pricing, is a pretty sophisticated discipline all of its own. I mean, it's got its own professional association. It's got its own certification program. People think of project management as, you know, Gantt charts and due dates. But it's a heck of a lot more than that. It's allocating resources. It's planning capacity into the future. It's looking at risk and uncertainty. And I really think that firms need to become better at project management. And right now, the billable hour lets us off the hook. We don't have to think about value. We don't have to think about project management. We don't have to think about managing client expectations because we just pick up a file and bill hours and then pray that the client doesn't complain when they get the bill. I think we have to put more thinking into the front end of the engagement and try and understand clients' value, what we're going to put into it, and that does require some pretty good project management. I guess you guys would call it case management.
Well, this is Jerry again. My follow-up, though, is I got confused by your answer in unit billing. To me, in a litigation file, why can't we put a price on a complaint? We know if we've done enough complaints, we know what the value is in our time, and then we know what the resources are. Why can't we give a fixed price for a complaint?
You can. I guess I just don't want you to have a list anywhere in an engagement letter or menu somewhere in your office that has all these different units at a fixed price.
Well, no, every complaint's going to have a different price to it.
Correct. Bingo. Then that's fine. Because you're going to be able to, as long as you're pricing it up front before you do the work, then that's exactly what we're talking about.
It seems to me it would be great to put a seminar together where we put all these litigating lawyers out there and we try to brainstorm how to model and value price these products, because in my mind, at least, you can clearly go from the analysis letter to the complaint answering and I guess counterclaim through the discovery, mediation, trial, appeal, and phase them all. Question of how you value them.
Ron, you can have a conversation with me about that, what it would take to sort of bring you someplace that we could take a day, and especially I think it's a little bit more, I think the transactional attorneys can see an easier way to approach this than some of the family law, criminal laws do. It does a pretty good job of value pricing, but family law and the litigation practices, and do a day that we could come together and just sort of work through some of these issues for a day.
And Jerry, let me give you a follow-up answer. Another incredible tool to evaluate how effective your pricing is to do what the Army calls an after-action review. And I'm just amazed how many firms don't do this, but it's a great tool because you go in after a file is closed and you get everybody who worked on it and you sit around and you ask basically four questions. What did we plan to happen on this engagement? What were the expectations? What actually happened? Why was there a gap between what we thought would happen and what actually happened? And how can we improve next time? Now, those are the basic questions. There's a lot more. But sitting around and talking about a closed file when you know what's happened, you know all the facts and circumstances, is a great way to learn and improve the process next time. And imagine having a database, just like the U.S. Army, of after-action reviews on all sorts of different engagements. how much knowledge would be in there that would be able to extract and continuously improve the process of pricing and getting at client expectations. And I have a sample AAR I'd be happy to send. I'll send it to Mark, and maybe, Mark, you can post it on the website, but a sample after-action review of questions that I think are just incredibly valuable. And I'm not expecting you to AAR every single engagement, but the big ones, I would expect that we'd spend some time and do that. I think it's incredibly valuable.
Good. We'll post that, Ron. And, Jerry, I'll talk to Ron and see if we can create something.
I appreciate that.
Other questions for Ron?
This is Randy Love in Port Richie.
Hey, Randy.
Mind if I ask a question here?
Please, go ahead.
I'm a trial attorney and doing commercial litigation, and usually when a file comes in, I can tell probably if it goes all the way through trial, what the client's gonna spend on the case, and I've been pretty good at being able to ballpark those.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I chase away the price shoppers by requiring a pretty hefty evergreen retainer up front.
Beautiful.
In terms of the value pricing, though, should I be charging the full, if I know what it's going to cost me or pretty accurate, should I then just unit price that or value price that up at the front end and ask for the thing at once? I'm curious as to how you, because you're right, the $80,000 engagement, I could see that on quite a few of these commercial litigation cases, you quote that to the client, but then you're taking a $10,000, $20,000 retainer. They're still used to the billable hour process. How do you handle that?
Well, this goes back to the chain that we talked about at the beginning. I want you to have a conversation with the client about the value to them. Now, they're not going to come out and directly tell you, that would be worth $100,000 to me if you could solve this, and you might be able to solve it in an hour, while standing in the shower or something. But to the extent that you can try and have a conversation based on the value to the client, what are we trying to achieve, what would this be worth to you, and try and get them to articulate that value, what it would be worth to them in frame of mind, peace of mind, not having to do these depositions, all of these other things, I think it's much easier to work back from that value to establish a price. I am not suggesting that you can capture 100% of that value. All I'm suggesting is the gap between the value perceived by the client and the billable hour that we're now charging is pretty big, and that we could tap in and get some more of it. In other words, we're leaving a ton of money on the table by pricing by the hour because we're so focused on the inputs and the costs rather than the value to the client. So I'd work back from value.
Can I have a real quick follow-up?
Sure.
In terms of how they're going to pay that, let's say the value is $80,000. Are you suggesting that we try and get a check then, or do we put them on a payment plan?
Well,
I have experimented in the past with just a flat monthly fee for services for industrial clients, where for a flat fee I handle any of their litigation issues or anything like that that comes up.
It's a great question. I think the legal profession here kicks butt on every other profession known to man because you guys are taught to get retainers and not to increase your cash flow, but to get buy-in from the customer. Once I give you a check, you're my lawyer. I mean, that's how I start thinking about you. We've changed the dynamics of the relationship. So I'm a big advocate of getting some type of retainer, a fourth, a third, a half of your fixed price up front. But I'll give you another idea for a value proposition. In terms of structuring payments, rather than trying to put it based on our workflow or trial dates, why not base it based on the client's business, if they are a business? They have a certain budget. They have a certain cash flow probably over the course of a year. Why not structure payment terms that are, simpatico with that cash flow rather than our workflow? And clients love that. For example, Christmas retailers may not want to pay you anything in the summer when they're broke, but towards the end of the year and the beginning of the year, they'd be more willing to pay a higher amount. So structure the payment terms around their cash flow. And businesses love that because they all work on budgets.
Thank you.
Sure.
I think we have time for one last question.
Why, did we lose everybody?
No, they're there.
Well, and I'll throw one in. It's Lonnie here again. One of the things that you suggest, again, in your book is about when you're negotiating a price with a client, to get the client involved in setting that price. Not only the terms of payment and how it's going to be paid, which you just talked about, but actually setting the price with the client. Now, how do you do that?
Right. There's various ways to do that. You can always ask them what the budget is. Except that, you know, I've learned over time that people will give you a low ball on that number, and the fact is there's always a budget. If the need is big enough, they'll find money from somewhere else. One of the way pricers do that is just the way Starbucks does it, is to offer various options to the client. You know, maybe you can bundle in different services at different levels, like a green card, gold card, platinum card, and then the client picks the option that's best for them. That's a very effective strategy. You know, the airline strategy, would you rather sit in the back of the plane or would you rather sit in front first class and offer various pricing points, you know, throughout. That's another way to get at the client's perception of value. And just the questions to ask the customer, just having a fantastic dialogue, conversation with the customer, you'll get better at this over time. I think you get an antenna or a radar that clues you into value perceptions from the client, especially if you're doing after-action reviews. If you can go into a closed file afterwards, talk to everybody who worked on that, and ask questions. One of the questions on the AAR is, what was the client's price sensitivity before and after the engagement? In other words, did it go up or did it go down? And that's going to be able to help you frame future pricing engagements as well. Lonnie, let me give you another answer. I'll tell you how McKinsey does it, and I think their approach is very effective. One of the first things McKinsey consultants will tell a client is, we won't even work for you unless we can justify, based on value, our price by a factor of 3. Now, I think that's an incredibly brilliant strategy because right out of the gate, they're talking about value.
Hmm.
They're starting at that higher level. They're not talking about inputs, consulting days, hours. They're talking about value and then working back to price. And I think that's just a great way to frame the conversation. But try different conversational approaches, and trust me, the more you do this, the better you get at it. It really is an art, and there's no formula for it. I think that's one of the things that's frustrating about this transition for most professionals. Right now, you have a formula. And I would argue strenuously that that formula produces a precisely wrong answer. But at least it's precise, and it gives us a sense of comfort, where I'm throwing you into a world that's a lot more vague, that's a lot more art, a lot more judgment, but I think it's, you know, much more profitable.
Ron, thank you for being available for the question and answer. It's just
I can't believe how fast it went, Mark.
I know it, and it's brilliant work. And I think as people experiment with this, I don't know, maybe sometime in the future, it's great to touch in with you and say, well, we tried this, tried that, it worked. What do you think? I love Jerry's idea. Maybe you and I can talk about what it would take to take you, so we could have some graduates meet you in person and then work through a process and experiment, then discuss the experiments and those sort of things. But
sure.
Most,
well, Mark, I'm in. You can sign me up first.
thanks, Jerry. You're reserved. Mostly, Ron, thank you for making the time. You know, everyone should know, for the Graduate Network, Ron doesn't get compensated for this. You can tell he's passionate about it. He's committed to it. He lives, breathes this. So we're grateful to have you participate. And let me just give out Ron's website one more time. You can get to him through the Atticus website, or you can just go to his directly, www.verasage, verasage.com. And one quick question, Ron, is there anything we can do to support you? Because we know you have a business as well, but is there anything we can do to support you in your efforts, besides buy your books?
Well, but yeah, the only thing, I mean, I'm not really out to sell anybody anything. The most we'll ever sell you at Verasage is a book. Go to our website, folks. There's a ton of resources there, under the community blog section. You'll find just a ton of great blog posts on this that will link to other blog posts. And also in the Trailblazer section on the website, you will see firms that are implementing this. and you can kind of read managing partner descriptions of how they've done it. Now, there are not too many law firms up there. They're mostly accounting firms, but it's the same principle that applies, and all of the fellows on the VeriSage website are also resources that you can tap into, so you can email us. And we also provide links to their blogs, and there's just a lot of just incredible content out there, and it's all free.
Well, thanks again, Ron, and thanks to everyone being on the call. We'll see you on the next Graduate Network call, and Ron, we'll be in touch with you. And, again, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Ron, thanks, Mark.